You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by PASA Sustainable Agriculture. Register now for PASA's 2023 conference in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, featuring more than 90 sessions on farming and food systems, as well as mixers and meetups and a trade show. Learn more at pasafarming.org/conference.
Welcome inside Julia's Kitchen, the podcast of the Julia Child Foundation for Gastronomy and the Culinary Arts. I'm your host, Todd Shulkin, the Foundation's Executive Director. Our show takes you inside the Foundation's world to meet the talented people we have the great fortune of learning from all the time. On today's show, we welcome Resy's Editorial Director, Paolo Lucchese. In this episode, we'll talk to Paolo about the state of the restaurant industry, what to expect dining out in 2023, and we'll hear Paolo's Julia moment. Stay with us. We'll be right back. As always, we launch the conversation with an inspiration from Julia. Julia liked to be in the know about the latest trends, and she loved dining out. Yeah, certainly she was into the chefs, tasting their dishes, discovering their techniques, and advocating for those who really impressed her. But she also loved the whole experience, going out, dining with friends, both new and old. After all, it was lunch at a particular French restaurant in Rouen that changed the trajectory of her entire life. At the Foundation, we believe that if Julia was still with us, she would have been actively involved in supporting restaurants through the challenges presented and exposed by the pandemic. That's what spurred us to make multiple grants over the last few years for restaurant relief, including supporting World Central Kitchen's initiative to repurpose shuttered restaurant kitchens. We granted $50,000 to support San Francisco, Oakland, New York City, Boston, and Honolulu Chinatown venues to feed the food insecure in their communities, chosen by 2022 Julia Child Award recipient Grace Young. Just as Julia was, the Foundation is committed to supporting restaurants and those dedicated to making hospitality happen. It's clear we are at a point of profound and likely permanent change. So as we forward into 2023, we wanted to get some expert insight. Someone who has his finger on the pulse of the restaurant industry is Resy's editorial director, Paolo Lucchese. If you haven't used Resy yet, it's a digital reservation system as well as an operating system used by restaurants in hospitality management. Started in 2014, Resy was acquired by American Express in 2019. Resy aspires to be a go-to destination for diners by offering exclusive access, original content, and chef-driven events. Born and raised in South San Francisco, Paolo was a reporter and editor at the San Francisco Chronicle, covering the Northern California food scene before joining Resy. He's co-written several cookbooks, including Flour Plus Water Pasta and A Burger to Believe In. Before working at the Chronicle, Paolo was the founding editor of Eater San Francisco and later at Eater National. He joins us today to talk about the current state of the restaurant industry and share his insights about what we can expect dining out in 2023. Welcome to the podcast, Paolo.
Thanks so much for having me.
We're glad you could join us. So let's start with, hopefully you can shine an optimistic light on something that sometimes seems rather dire, but how bad is it out there for restaurants right now?
It's a big question, right? It's complicated, I guess, is the easy answer. I think, whenever we we talk about like kind of, you know, these macro dining trends. I think it's important to note that, you know, restaurants aren't a monolith. The industry is not a monolith. So it's, you know, it's a lot of variation from certainly from city to city, from kind of restaurant to kind of restaurant, from neighborhood to neighborhood. But, you know, it's tough right now, I'm not going to lie, for a lot of restaurants. I think, you know, as we enter the new year, you know, January, February, those are traditionally slow months. And after that big holiday boost, hopefully, but you know, some restaurants will get a little boost this week with Lunar New Year. Valentine's Day is obviously a huge day. But otherwise, you know, the winter months are usually a little slower. But then there's these so many other factors that are really challenging restaurants right now. A lot of it is, you know, you take it into context of what's happened the last few years with restaurants, and you know, the industry is changing and being forced to evolve in a lot of ways that I think, you know, hopefully do improve it in the long run. But there's a lot of growing pains right now, and what's kind of proving to be almost like a new normal for restaurants. You know, the industry's kind of, you know, endured this, you know, this series of storms, you know, since the pandemic started now almost 3 years ago. You know, you saw like this evolution of what they've had to deal with is just storm upon storm. You know, obviously the pandemic shutdowns were huge. You know, the openings, reopenings, closings, you know, all the variants coming in. And then also all these other things like, you know, costs have skyrocketed. The supply chains are tough. Debts have accumulated. Staffing has been a constant problem. But, you know, I think one thing we've seen is that, you know, a lot of restaurants are still here. Restaurants are resilient. The industry is so resilient. And to cope with a lot of these challenges, operations have changed, and you know they will continue to. But it's, you know, it's the good news is that the demand is there. I think you know, generally speaking, I think it's probably fair to say 2022 was the year that dining really surged back after some tough years. So like diners want to go out. By and large, we're seeing in our data that, you know, the demand is higher than it's ever been, even the, going back to pre-pandemic levels. So there's a lot of optimism there. I think you're seeing that restaurants have certainly in the last 10 years become part of pop culture. You know, I think there's a lot of optimism in addition to, you know, the obvious challenges from the industry side of it. So it's going to be a continued dance.
Yeah, that's similar to what we've heard from folks we work with, particularly from our home base in Santa Barbara, which is the demand is really strong, but the ability to meet the demand is still really challenging, partly because of supply chains, but mostly, especially in a community that has sort of unique dynamics like Santa Barbara from staffing. And I feel like that's also impacting diners in the sense that a lot of diners are returning, as you said, in 2022 with kind of 2019 expectations. And I was just curious from, you know, Resi's experience, what your customers are telling you about, you know, how they're experiencing this changed world, and also the places that they're eating at, you know, the level of service, or what have you guys been hearing and finding?
Yeah, I mean, for these big kind of trend like questions, we always try to see what we can contribute to the conversation with Resi. And, you know, so we try to look at our data a lot. And I think that's a really helpful way to kind of look at this stuff. You know, and also maybe goes back to my background as a reporter, where, you know, you really got to, you know, show your work and kind of, and, you know, one thing that we're seeing is, you know, like we're diner behavior has changed, given that the restaurant industry is restaurant operations are so different now. You know, people are, you know, it's harder to get into a lot of restaurants because, you know, maybe restaurants are closed, you know, maybe two or three extra days than they were pre-pandemic. You know, I think, and when they're closed, you know, or when they are open rather, they're closing earlier or they're opening later, or, you know, so hours are changed. So it's not, and that's, you know, in a lot of ways, that's how a lot of restaurants are finding sustainability, not only from a business side, but from a personal side, a people side, a human side. You know, giving, you know, not making their staff, you know, work until 2 a.m. is what a lot of folks are doing here in San Francisco. You know, giving staff a little more quality of life. And those are all like really great changes for the human side of it. But, you know, diners have to adjust as well. It's a, like I said, it's a dance between both sides of seeing what works, what is sustainable. But for example, you know, like we're seeing more reservations at 5 p.m. than 2019. So, you know, stuff like that where people are eating earlier. We're seeing more people set notifies, which is, you know, basically kind of, you know, if there's not a reservation, you can set a notify on Resy and you can pop up, or if someone gets, if there's a cancellation, you can slide into that spot. So, you know, twice as many people are setting notifies now than in September 2022 than September 2019. And those that are setting are setting them more. So like, you know, diner behavior will continue to change, I think, as well.
Well, I think that's interesting with the whole, you know, photographing your food culture of Instagram coming up. It sort of, in 2019, pre-pandemic, it already felt like dining out was kind of a competitive sport. So I feel like the restricted supply may only, especially with the latest, hottest places, kind of intensify that. But are you finding more feedback from diners where their expectations aren't being met or they're getting more frustrated? Or do you actually think people get it and are kind of understanding, especially those people who are, you know, into food? What have you been hearing in that regard?
Yeah, I think most people get it. That's anecdotal, but I mean, we don't deal in like user reviews a lot, you know, so we don't really have, you know, we're not going to hear that noise, like in a way that like Yelp would. But you know, I think what is interesting on that front is, you know, like, as you know, a major thing that, that restaurants are kind of finding their way now is, you know, prices. So a lot of restaurants have had to raise prices in the last few years, let alone last few months, due to a confluence of issues, to try to find that sustainable path for their individual business. But you know, we did a poll with 1,000 consumers, diners, and you know, 41% said they would be willing to pay higher prices if they knew the staff was treated well. For Gen Z, that's 59%. So like said, they would pay a premium. So I think, you know, I think it's going to be a culture shift to understand that you're probably going to have to pay more at a lot of restaurants compared to what you were earlier, a few years ago. But I think if people can start to understand the why and, you know, why you're paying more, and it's, you know, certainly maybe it's because of staff, maybe it's pay higher wages, maybe it's because ingredients simply cost more, maybe it's because the restaurant is only open, you know, fewer days a week and has to be sustainable. So I think there's that education component that's seeping into the mainstream eventually.
Yeah, I was struck by, I've lived abroad quite a lot, and it's interesting that this model is much closer to a European model of restaurants are not open as long hours. They don't have as many people staffing the restaurant, and they, you know, are only open certain days of the week, and they just have more restrictions. It's not the standard, and we've talked to many people who said they think this is going to evolve too, like the traditional American model of customer service, which is the customer is always right, and we, you know, do backflips until they're all satisfied. Yeah. Do you also feel like that is part of the potential evolution, not necessarily to a European model, but to a more, I don't know, restricted and controlled model of what is service by restaurants?
Absolutely. I think you hit the nail on the head with, you know, there are a lot of influences that are in the European model, and also, you know, other around the world as well, where, you know, it's certainly the customer approach that you mentioned, but even just like, you know, menus are smaller now. That's just how it is for a lot of restaurants. Again, restaurants aren't a monolith, but, you know, I think you are seeing more smaller menus, limited items, more set menus you're seeing, because it's just simply easier to staff, easier to prepare, easier to limit food waste, easier to control costs. That's something that's common in Europe, where, you know, you have fewer options on the menu. That's totally fine. And another thing is also, you know, there's obviously, this has been in the works for years, but it finally sees, like, you know, it's still moving. Whereas, like, you know, rethinking the tipping conundrum, which has been, you know, written about for the last 10 years, but, you know, here in San Francisco, you know, it feels like it's got another wave, and, you know, maybe it'll stick this time a little more than it has in the five years ago. So there's a lot of models from abroad that are starting to be incorporated more and more in the States.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a second, because we honored Danny Meyer with the Julia Child Award early on. I think it was the third year, and he had been one of the innovators at his different restaurants, mostly New York Union Square Hospitality Group, of no tipping. And I felt like right before the pandemic, it was not working. There was too much customer, and particularly actually front of house staff revolt. But I feel like all the, you know, especially now I'm in Los Angeles where dining out is expensive. There's all kinds of surcharges. So, and tipping, and also now even, this is not exactly dining out, but almost every point of sale food purchases prompts you to tip right in front of the staff member. I try to, although I find half the time it's not even acknowledged. So then you're like caught between guilt and dissatisfaction, but it just seems also sort of out of control. And that I would like to think this, let's call it a European idea, that everyone is paid a fair wage and has benefits is a model we're moving to. But I felt like we already were tried it and there was so much pushback. Are you seeing more of it actually kind of bubbling up again as a potential model?
I am, yeah. Here in San Francisco, we've got a lot of leading restaurants who are, you know, giving it another go, so to speak. And I think, you know, I think there's a lot of, you know, benefits to it. And hopefully it, you know, I think consumer education is stronger where it was a few years ago. And I think a lot of restaurants that are trying it again have learned from the mistakes of the past as well in terms of, you know, how you deliver this message to diners. In addition to, like, as you mentioned, the, you know, figuring out a way that it doesn't, you know, that the front of house staff is in favor of it as well, and really just breaking down those barriers with the team as a whole for a restaurant, as opposed to really having a front versus back of house dynamic, which I think is one of the dangers of kind of the last generation that tried to do this. I think that was there was friction there, but now I think you're seeing a lot of folks really trying to build something new from the ground up. As opposed to bend something that wasn't working before. A restaurant and bar in San Francisco called Bar Agricole or Good Culture Club. These are restaurants that really, you know, stripped down their operations to the bare bones and have tried to rebuild something better than it was in the past.
Yeah, no, I hope that people continue to focus on that because I think that the tipping culture is very out of balance. As we've talked about on other episodes, so much of the whole model of the way restaurants are structured, which has nothing to do with the decisions made by individual restaurateurs versus government and state, federal and state regulations of how people are paid, goes back to a period of gross discrimination and inequity. And it would maybe even the more people understand that its roots are even based in that, that they'll be even, you know, kind of embracing a more fair model that also is just ultimately easier and more transparent for the diner.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, 100%.
So let's talk for a minute about Resy, because you guys are a little bit newer to the scene than some of the other services people might be totally familiar with or have used a lot, like OpenTable. And yeah, I was interested that you guys kind of are covering service-wise and maybe customer-wise both sides. But I was just curious, yeah, are you actually more of a restaurant management tool that happens to serve as diners? Or are you guys also a tool for diners? Or is it 50-50? How does Resy describe it?
Yeah, I think it's both. I think we're a tool for restaurants and a tech tool for restaurants and a service for diners. I mean, I think we are both, and one fuels the other. And, you know, I think that's kind of a big reason of, you know, what we do well, I hope. You know, the mission statement of Resy since its inception has been that we want to forge the future of the restaurant industry. And, you know, we want to be this essential resource for anyone who is dining obsessed. And, you know, so we're here in this kind of space that sits between diners' love of restaurants and the best restaurants in the world. And we want to bring that connection to life. So, you know, as you think about, like, you know, I'm very proud of, I'm the editorial director. So, you know, we have a great content team and we just tell the stories of these restaurants. And it's so great to be able to, you know, connect diners with the restaurants they want to go to. I don't believe there's a quote unquote best restaurant, but I think there might be, you know, a best one for you tonight that you want to go to. And so we want to kind of forge these connections and tell the stories of the people who work at restaurants who, you know, because with the idea that, you know, if you know the people who cook your food, if you understand what goes into a restaurant, then you'll appreciate it more. You'll like it more, and you'll just have, you know, a better experience. And obviously, and then you can make the reservation right on the page. It's, you know, it's just like a one-stop shop for anyone who loves restaurants. That's the idea.
Yeah, no, I think it's important to also remind people that, you know, you can have the best food in the world, but if you don't have the hospitality side down, it doesn't matter and it will likely fail. The movie, The Menu, if people have seen that, sort of illustrates that quite well now of how it can be. Or there was even going back to the Seinfeld episode with the soup Nazi, and that was sort of a parody of that. But I think people often lose sight of, and even I think chefs sometimes lose sight of that ultimately, actually, a restaurant with mediocre food and great hospitality can actually succeed maybe as well, if not better, than one with great food and really poor hospitality.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the magic of restaurants, right? In any city that you live in, like, you have such a wealth of options, most cities at least, and it could, you know, whether you want, you know, restaurant A or restaurant B, like, it's just, that's the magic of restaurants, is you can have so many different options. It's all this cultures of the world right around the corner. It's just amazing. And, you know, you forge connections with restaurants, you become a regular. That to me that's what makes restaurants so special. Like the communities, and just, you know, the way that, you know, you can understand culture, connections, life through food, celebration. These are all things that you experience at restaurants. And I think that's something that really, for me personally, became clarified during the pandemic, where, you know, a lot of restaurants were just, you know, hurting so bad, closed altogether. And, you know, that's what we lose when we lose restaurants from a city. And, you know, there's nothing like restaurants. They're really just a unique thing. And that's kind of why it's, I just think it's a fascinating topic of conversation. Their businesses, their culture, their community, it's, you know, they're a really nuanced, you know, organism almost.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that was also what the pandemic exposed, is how much people missed that and saw it as more than just eating out or a place to eat, that it really was both things. And maybe that's what's been driving this surge back in 2022, is it's not just the food. As I was saying at the top of the show, what Julia loved about it was the entire experience, which was very much about social and community.
Yeah.
All right. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back with more about the future of dining out with Resy's editorial director, Paolo Lucchese. Stay with us.
Cultivate farms and food systems that nourish, heal, and empower. Register now for PASA Sustainable Agriculture's 2023 conference. Access more than 90 sessions on topics including environmental conservation, food justice, sustainable food and textile production, renewable energy, and much more. Featuring a not-to-be-missed lineup of speakers, including indigenous environmental scientist and author of Fresh Banana Leaves, Jessica Hernandez, the best-selling author of The Art of Fermentation, Sandra Katz, co-owners of Heritage Seed Company, True Love Seeds, Owen Taylor and Chris Bolden Newsome, and many more. PASA's conference takes place in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, on February 8th through 11th, and includes social networking events plus an expansive trade show. Register now at pasafarming.org/conference. That's pasafarming.org/conference.
Welcome back. We're talking to Resy's editorial director, Paolo Lucchese, about what to expect while dining out this year. So let's talk about trends. What are you foreseeing? What is Resy predicting in terms of either the trends or how dining out will be defined in 2023?
Yeah, it's a really good question, big question. It was funny, I was listening to Jamila Robinson last week, or last year, about the trends, and she was just like so spot on in all her prognoses for the year. So there's a lot of pressure to replicate, but I think a lot of what she says, I think a lot of what she says holds true this year. I think you're seeing a lot of the similar themes, to be honest. But I a few things that we've kind of like that I think that I'm excited about, that we're excited about. I think we're clearly seeing a new wave of just evolution of like the tasting menu, I think is a really thing that we've kind of noticed a lot across our markets. I think tasting menus, traditionally they have this box that they've been in. You know, it's very French, Japanese with omakase menus, which is a little different, but still like this, you know, this coursed out long experience, or maybe not so long some in many cases. But we're really seeing a new generation of chefs and restaurants becoming using that format. And I think we have a columnist who was nominated for a James Beard Award this year, Mahira Rivers, and she wrote about this topic. And I think her perspective was so awesome, because really thinking about like, you know, a West African influenced restaurant like Ikoyi in London, or, you know, Kasama in Chicago, which is modern Filipino. And you're having all these different cuisines that have not traditionally used a tasting menu format, use a tasting menu format in new and exciting ways. And I think it says a few things. I think certainly there's a business rationale to it, because as we mentioned earlier, you know, it's a little easier to control costs with a menu like that. But also, you know, this is a format that has been reserved for, you know, what we think of, you know, as quote unquote fancy food, maybe like a French or Japanese, but, you know, really being able to fight for these chefs are positioning their own cultures as worthy to pay more for. And, you know, and I think that's what the tasting menu format, it's, you can tell a story in a tasting menu that you can't in another way. And it's not to say, you know, these restaurants need to be like $1,000, like many of the Michelin 3-star restaurants. You know, you could have a tasting menu experience for, you know, maybe $100. But being able to push that form to new places, that are, you know, maybe a little more, lively than some of the jewel boxes of the past. And those aren't, I think there's a place for all restaurants. Like, you know, like I said, it's what you the diner are looking for. But this is almost like a new branch of the tasting menu tree that is really growing. It's really exciting. And I'm gonna quote Mahira, because she said it better than I could, because, you know, she says those experiences feel like opportunities to challenge assumptions, including my own, her own, of how certain cuisines should present themselves. And it feels right to see every cuisine translated to something as special and story-driven as a tasting menu. And forgive me, I'm a writer by background, so, you know, I feel like it's easier to express via writing than off the cuff sometimes. But I think that was just like, that's just a perfect encapsulation of that trend that I'm really excited to see. We see some of those in San Francisco as well, like, you know, places like California's, or High Felicia, which is Chef Amana's, you know, it's like a supper club menu. And, you know, that's just really, you sit at a long table, they bring you a course down menu, and it's just, you know, it's a good time. It's just, you know, you're in a room with new people for an evening. And it's just like, you know, this is not, you know, a precious, you know, course down menu in the way that you might have experienced it 10 years ago. This is something that's really exciting, I think. So I think that's a really exciting development. You know, elsewhere, I think, you know, you're going to continue to see a lot of, you know, I think you have different markets that are kind of, you know, popping up. You know, I think we've been kind of watching what's happening in Miami. Miami has a ton of new restaurants, both from their Miami owned restaurant groups, but also a lot of other restaurant groups are opening in Miami, and that's a really booming place. I think they did very well from a restaurant point of view during the pandemic, and they're continuing to surge there as that becomes more of a dining destination compared to maybe where it was, you know, a decade or two ago. And I think that's really interesting. But yeah, no, I think there's lots of fun stuff coming up. A lot of it is dictated by finances. You know, I think that's, you know, to tasting menus, I think you're going to see more, again, more omakase restaurants, because that is a very strong business model. You know, it's the cost of labor is relatively low compared to a more staffed restaurant. And obviously you can control costs, and kind of a little sibling offshoot of that is kind of lots of hand roll restaurants. Tamaki restaurants are popping up across the country, and again, it's a similar business model as the omakase, but at a lower price point. So I think that's also really exciting, and you're also seeing that kind of trickle down into, you know, non-Japanese menus as well. Just those hand rolls, where, you know, more more restaurants are just putting them on the menu because people love them and they're Instagrammable probably.
I wanted to go back to your comment about Miami, and I was just, you know, because Miami is a big city and a fun and tourist place, but you could define New York is that, LA is that, San Francisco is that, Chicago is that. What do you what is going on in Miami that is unique or standing out, or you guys are sending journalists there to try to figure out yourselves?
Yeah, no. We always love to work with journalists on the ground. So, you know, as opposed to sending someone from, you know, New York or LA or whoever. We've commissioned a bunch of stories from our folks in our friends in Miami. And it's kind of a confluence of things. I think certainly there's a lot of outsiders coming in. You know, you have the Robichon. I think you've got certainly a major food group, which, you know, brought Carbone there, among other restaurants. You've got Daniel Boulud. You know, you've got a bunch of, you know, these largely New York folks. Cote is there, the Korean restaurant. But more so than that, I think the really part is, you know, it's the rest. There's about a decade ago, I think there was a groundswell of Miami owners, chefs, operators, who really were, you know, changed the city. And as chefs with the roots in the city began, they kind of started opening in the mid-2000s, a lot of like kind of just more neighborhood restaurants. And these were restaurants that maybe didn't like kind of necessarily fit in this, you know, that stereotypical neon Miami mold of, you know, whatever you want to think of Miami stereotypes. These were like really just amazing food, and they push forward Miami's food culture. You know, folks like Michelle Bernstein, who, you know, Niven Patel. So like these were really a new generation of restaurants, and they've just continued to build and build and build. And this is something that takes years to build this, a new generation of like really a Miami language, you know, and now you see it a lot, like in places like Mandolin and Macchialina. These are really just awesome restaurants. Boya Day just got a Michelin star this year. And, you know, those restaurants have come to maturity in the last decade plus, and now they're opening new offshoots because, you know, when a restaurant is successful, like that, those are some opportunities that come. You can open more restaurants. You want to take care of your staff. If you have a, you know, a great chef de cuisine, maybe you want to give her own restaurant. So these are the kind of ways that, you know, that generations can build, and really like a really, a new restaurant culture can build as well. And so I think that's kind of one thing that happened in Miami. And certainly there was, you know, I think outside restaurant groups saw opportunity. You know, Massimo Bottura is opening there later this year. And, you know, I think there's, you know, it's a population that clearly is enjoying restaurant culture right now. I think they've enjoyed it throughout the last 2 years. And, you know, I mean, maybe there's, I think you're getting a lot of, it's a nice combination of tourists and locals. It's, you know, it's almost, it seems to me as someone who's kind of, you know, seen the evolution over that last decade of, you know, where these, you know, larger restaurant groups seem to gravitate towards, you know, I think once upon a time it was Vegas. And I think that's still certainly the case to some degree, but I think there's a magnetic draw to Miami right now as well.
Yeah, no, that's really beautifully painted. I kind of get it now. It's a little bit, you guys are picking up on, it's almost like Miami is maturing into a full-blown international food city in the way that San Francisco did after New York and LA did. And it's sort of joining, it's not so much that it's like Miami, it's this maturing of all these seeds that were planted years and years ago. And it's kind of hit a tipping point, which is both from inside and then people recognizing that from the outside and joining.
Absolutely.
Which I have to say, I might get criticism for this, but I think it's slightly different than Las Vegas, which is all these people went in and made it more of a food city. Happy to hear from Las Vegas listeners who would counter that point of view. I was surprised by this part of that study that you mentioned that Resy commissioned that said that 43% of Gen Xers would choose a steakhouse for special occasion dining. And for me, with my own biases and preferences, that would no longer ever occur to me. But I would, you know, sitting in Los Angeles where plant-based is all the thing, or all different kinds of ethnic cultures are really the focus, it struck me about, is that also a contextual thing that when you look at the country as a whole, there's a different point of view? And do we have sort of skewed perspectives on the coast? Or what was Rezi's take on that? That's really surprised me in 2023. Although it's looking backward, but
yeah, I mean, here and I'm in San Francisco, and I, you know, we're not too far apart in California, but it surprised me too. But then, you know, the more I thought about it, you know, maybe it's not so surprising, and I think it's maybe a combination of two factors. I think, you know, we're maybe not, you know, here in San Francisco, like, you know, the ultimate celebratory restaurant is House of Prime Rib. That place is every generation. It's, you know, the 49ers and the Giants go there to celebrate. They have big things there. It's the place where you'll still see, you know, former mayors, but you'll also see, you know, a whole new generation of families and, you know, young kids and Gen Zers. So it's for everybody. And that's a place where, you know, you see it, they just have their thing down. And so I think there's a lot of groundswell still for, you know, steakhouses. And I guess your listeners can debate if a prime rib house is a steakhouse, if that counts as steak. But
it's certainly a meat focused place. But actually, I get what you're saying in the sense that actually the one tradition that I think steakhouses, particularly that are expensive, which more often or not they are because of what they serve, they have the tradition of hospitality down pat. And certainly from what we were talking about at the top of the show, that if you're going to go out for a celebration with a group, you're going to select somewhere where you know you can rely on the hospitality factor in addition to the food.
So, and it's a show without that, you know, maybe the, like we mentioned, like the $1,000 price point of some of the Michelin star restaurants. And, you know, it's also a little more, it's accessible because you can maybe choose what you want to order in a way that you can at some other high-end restaurants. It's special without, you know, being over the top necessarily. But it's a show, it's entertainment. You know, you'll get your fancy martinis and, you know, you get the shakers going and, you get maybe, tableside carving or tableside Caesar salad toss, you know, stuff like that. And then I think the other thing that I think is really interesting is you're also seeing a new generation of steakhouses that are kind of coexisting along the older ones. You know, I think a good dichotomy is seen in New York, where you have Four Charles Prime Rib, which is an exclusive supper club that's one of the city's most sought after restaurants on Resi. That place is one of the top, you know, notified spots in the city. It's very modern, without kind of, but still kind of keeps the best parts of that steakhouse, that, you know, that dim supper club ambience. And then, right, you know, then you got Peter Luger's, and that kind of is the same idea. It's like, you know, that's where people are still going. And, you know, even in a place like LA, you know, you have places like Dear John's and American Beauty, and those are also kind of redefining the steakhouse genre through this modern LA California lens, you know, and, you know, I think there's still this, it's a genre that is getting updated. And then as we pass through time, the places that have been around, you know, kind of evolve into this legacy status and this kind of almost like museum pieces in the best way possible, because, you know, you can't really, you know, replicate a lot of those places anymore. I think there's a lot of folks that are really updating it in a new way. I think Cote, which is in New York and Miami, that's giving that, you know, that Korean interpretation to, which obviously has a long, rich history of, you know, of awesome steaks. But yeah, so I think there's a lot of really interesting innovation and respect for the older folks as well.
I love that. Yeah. Unfortunately, in London, Cote is a terrible chain of, like, it is a steakhouse, but it's like, you know, serviced stuff comes in packets and stuff like that. So it's like launched in my head where I'm like, I won't go there anymore because I know it just all got defrosted in the microwave. But interested to check out the alternate new interpretation.
The other
Yeah, exactly. I was also, while we're on that, just because I'm personally really fascinated by these differences and maybe these unfortunate marketing guru labels, but are Gen Z diners, are you guys finding, are their expectations, because you mentioned that before about staffing and price points, are they, do you find that they're significantly different from Gen Xers, and are millennials somehow like lost in the shuffle between Gen Xers and Gen Zers, or Gen Xers and Gen Zers are the two people with enough disposable income to eat out, so millennials are stuck at home with their kids now?
Yeah, I guess I'm the millennial in that group. I think it's a hard question. I think it depends kind of how you frame it, to be honest. I think, like I mentioned, I think Gen Zers, and maybe this is me being a little more anecdotal, but, you know, I think Gen Zers have grown up with restaurants as pop culture a lot. You know, I think that started to shift in the last 10 to 20 years to really, you know, I think restaurants are mainstream in a way they weren't, you know, even with the dawn of the Food Network. I think it's shifted in the 2000s to something else. You know, it's not just Tyler Florence and Bobby Flay on the TV, and those guys also work in restaurants. Now, like, restaurants are the subject in a lot of, you know, pop culture. And so I think there's a different appreciation. I think the work that the food media as a whole has done in the past few years has really shifted the narrative in a great way to the people in the industry. You know, you're seeing so many more stories centering workers, centering the challenges that operators face. And I think that is, I think the Gen Zers in particular have kind of come of age in that era. So I think you are seeing some different kinds of attitude on that front. At the same time, you know, I think there's some, you know, more other differences. I think one difference is probably discovery of where different generations find restaurants to eat. I think discovery for Gen Zers is probably, it is largely TikTok and other social media, whereas, you know, some of the other ones might, you know, other generations probably still rely on media outlets, traditional media outlets. Not a video. I think you're seeing it's slightly different, but at the same time, I don't want to, you know, just overlook just the obvious, which is, I think, you know, you go to restaurants you love, and, you know, the best way to kind of get customers is, you know, create great experiences. And, you know, I think a lot of diners like to go to, you know, they rely on restaurants in their neighborhood. They rely on restaurants they love. They want to be regulars. And, you know, in one of our polls, it was, you know, the biggest places in addition to steakhouses for, you know, a celebratory meal is their tried and true favorites. And it is, and even more so, I think the one that really, the number that really got resonated with me is that, you know, it is the vast majority of diners, regardless of what generation they are, 93% of respondents say they believe that dinner at a restaurant is a necessary component of a special night out. And I think that resonates with me a lot, because I think that's something that's really universal across generations, across demographics, is, you know, a lot of people still, you know, whether it's, you know, a date or, you know, celebrating a life event or, you know, catching up with a friend, however you want to define special, a lot of that connection still happens at restaurants. And that's really, really resonant for me personally.
I think that's a great note to go to break on. We'll be right back to hear Paolo's Julia moment. Let us know what you think of today's show. Send us an email or voice memo to contact@juliachildfoundation.org. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
When you flip anything, you just have to have the courage of your convictions, particularly if it's sort of a loose mass like this. Well, that didn't go very well. See, when I flipped it, I didn't have the courage to do it the way I should have. But you can always pick it up, and if you're alone in the kitchen, who is going to see?
From Julia's immortal words, we move into our last segment, which we call the Julia Moment. Here is when we ask our guests to share their favorite Julia memory, moment, or how she might have inspired them in their career. Paolo, what's your Julia moment?
All right. Well, I have to admit, Julia was a bit before my time, so I don't have a traditional Julia moment. So I'm going to see if I can take the opportunity to zag, although I will do the asterisk of, you know, even just, you know, listening to your podcast, the courage of your convictions line that you play in the introduction to the segment, that resonates every time. And that's just like a North Star for me that I follow in my day-to-day life now. So thank you, Julia, for that. But my Julia moment is a bit maybe unorthodox. So I don't really have much experience with her because it's a little before my time. I wanted to spotlight Cecilia Chang. My connection is that Cecilia, who died in the last few years, was often dubbed the Julia Child of Chinese cooking in America. And I knew Cecilia here in San Francisco. She was incredibly kind. I miss her very much. And she was an amazing woman. A few things kind of really just still resonate with Cecilia. And I thought it was a good time also to bring up because, you know, this is Lunar New Year this week. But, you know, I think, first of all, like, even just the way in which everyone referred to her as the Julia Child of Chinese cooking in America, I think, obviously, that's a big compliment to both of them, I think. But, you know, as an editor, as someone who's worked in media, I think it also is a reminder for me of where, you know, we're centering people and the gaze of, you know, instead of, you know, it's not, Cecilia was very much her own woman. And I wish, as much as I respect Julia and Cecilia, I wish we could have just said she was the Cecilia Chang of China, of America, because I think she was just one of the most important figures in culture and cooking in American in the past century. That title has taught me that, you know, it's, I think media has done this a lot in the past to, you know, compare something that, you know, to the Western view of it or to the white view. And I think that approach really clarified a lot of kind of the way we talk about food and talk about culture. It's not just the blank of another country. So I think that's one, but maybe more, even more powerfully, you know, Cecilia was always so kind to me, and we met, you know, maybe years ago, but it was when I was over at Eater, and I was, you know, a mere blogger, and she was just so kind to me, and she welcomed me into her table. You know, we would go out to dinner. She loved to go out even into her late 90s. You know, she died at age 100 a few years ago. But it always struck me how she was so passionate about restaurants. And also just, she brought together different generations at the table. And I think that was just so powerful. It's a lesson, the way that she was welcoming of different generations. And I was, you know, several generations removed from her. But, you know, she had so many young people at her table, of whether it's chefs or pastry chefs or, you know, other writers, other people in the community. And it was never about, you know, she just led by example. It was always just a fun night at a restaurant. She was never trying to, like, you know, necessarily hold court or, you know, do something, whatever you want to call it. She was just so kind and generous with herself. And the idea of just being a leader and for generations. And I think she impacted so many people in across the country that she was just an amazing woman, and just wanted to give her a little love. So that's my Julia moment. It's maybe today will be a Cecilia moment.
That's terrific. I think that's 100% in the spirit of the Julia moment. And since you are an editor, I'm going to take the opportunity to leverage you bringing this up. At the Foundation, we fully support no one ever again referring to anybody as the Julia Child of this and that. And I will say, for those editors who might be listening to the show, because as many people don't realize, when journalists write stories, 9 times out of 10, unless it's a really tiny publication, someone else writes the headline. And those people, I'm sorry, are friggin' lazy. And that is where so many people have been anointed the Julia Child of this and that. Sometimes it's in the story, but more often or not, it's just in the headline. So we are 100% supportive of people stopping doing that, because as you say, people like Cecilia deserve their own recognition and don't need to be prepared. And it was certainly nothing Julia asked for. So it does bother me a little bit, though, that it ends up being sort of criticism of Julia when it was absolutely nothing Julia propagated. And we would be 100% fine with it ending right now.
Amen.
Thank you. So you work with other people. You know the folks at Eater. We need everyone's help. It can't just be stuff that comes back to Julia. So, but thank you. And we hope to have many more Julia moments that turn the gaze elsewhere. So we really appreciate you doing that, and especially in honor of Lunar New Year. So thank you very much for joining us, Paolo.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a joy.
And thanks, everyone, for listening. If you want to hear more from Paolo, it's at Paolo Lucchese, and it's at Rezzy on Instagram. Check out new Julia Child video clips from The French Chef at Julia Child on Facebook. Make sure you're following at Julia Child Foundation on Instagram, and I'm at T. Shulkin on Instagram. The 2023 Taste of Santa Barbara is coming up May 15th to 21st. Follow at SB Culinary Experience on Instagram for the latest news about events in and around Santa Barbara, including a soon-to-be-announced spring pop-up. The Julia Child audio clip from The French Chef is used with permission from our friends at GBH, thanks to my co-producer at the Foundation, Lauren Salkeld, and our sound engineer at Heritage Radio Network, Armin Spengen. Our theme song is New French Horn by Novi Valtorni. We're on the air on Heritage Radio Network on Thursdays at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific, with downloads available soon after, wherever you find your podcasts. We look forward to bringing you back into the Foundation's world next time on Inside Julia's Kitchen. Inside Julia's Kitchen is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.